transformation is only valid if it is carried out with the people, not for them. Liberation is like a childbirth, and a painful one. The person who emerges is a new person, no longer either oppressor or oppressed, but a person in the process of achieving freedom. And it is only the oppressed who, by freeing themselves, can then free their oppressors. And that was said by Paulo Freire. Welcome to Surviving the Matrix, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Maxwell Egan. It's a pleasure to be with you once again, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Well, the world is facing some very, very challenging times, folks. I've been sharing such information with you for quite a long time now on the air. And as I mentioned in the last show, and as I've been mentioning in several radio interviews that I've done on other stations this week, things are getting particularly urgent at the moment. We've gone through a lot of time attempting to help people achieve a state of fearlessness within themselves, a state of self-empowerment. We've attempted to help people discover who and what they are in order that they may stand in their power and stand with humanity to face the shadow and thereby heal the current dilemma that human consciousness finds itself in. But the time has come when we really must begin to walk the talk and to stand up and do so ourselves. This is why I've been working towards doing many public speaking events. I intend to go and do as many events as possible across Australia in the coming months in an attempt to reach as many people as I can. And that's why there are so many individuals now speaking out about this and traveling around the world and doing their bit to help people understand the urgency of the human race waking up from its slumber and addressing the problems that we face. One such gentleman is Ian R. Crane, who is currently touring Australia from the UK. Ian is speaking at venues across Sydney, Melbourne, the Gold Coast, Brisbane and New Zealand over the next couple of weeks, and I'll give you those dates a little bit later in the show. And Ian is one of these unique people who actually used to work for the other side, folks. He used to be an oil company executive. And so he is able to view things from a unique perspective that many people are not. And we're going to talk to him today and have a little bit of a look at where his research has been leading him and what he sees unfolding in the world and where he perceives it is that humanity may be heading for. And Ian now joins me from Melbourne, where he is speaking tonight. Ian Crane, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Max. I appreciate the invitation.
As I've just said in the intro, there's a lot of people speaking out about the global situation at the moment, but you come at things from a very unique perspective in as much as you're actually were part of the enemy for a little while. You're actually an oil company executive. And you had an experience that caused you to sort of look at things a little bit differently. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit of that for us. Like, did you just sort of one day suddenly wake up and think, oh, my God, I'm public enemy number 45? Or was there something that happened in your life that triggered this for you?
No. I certainly wasn't a sort of road to Damascus moment per se. There was a particular event that caused me to question my worldview. But, it took a while for me to really embrace and embody that experience. And up until that point, I certainly didn't perceive that, I was even in the belly of the beast. I mean, I was delusional enough to believe that I was, making my contribution to society, as it were, and being very well rewarded for it, I might add. But I went into Kuwait. I was actually based in the Middle East. I was based in Dubai. In the early 1990s, and I was one of the first civilians to go into Kuwait. I was employed by an oil field services company called Schlumberger, who I'd been with for about 12 years up to that time. And I went in with a couple of my colleagues, and our task was to go and take a look at the state of play in Kuwait after the end of hostilities there. And take a look at the logistics that we were going to need to employ to deal with this unprecedented situation. I can't remember exactly what number it was. I think it was about 600 and something oil fires. And there were four firefighting specialist teams there. Of course, the most famous one that people have heard of is Red Adair, although Red Adair never actually set foot in Kuwait himself. But it was Red Adair, Wild Well Control, Safety Boss, and Boots and Coots. And they were the four firefighting companies. And my company, Schlumberger, and of course the company that everybody has heard of, Halliburton, we were the two companies that were providing support, direct support, to these firefighting specialists. And at the time, I had one guy in the company that was really very, very well versed in firefighting techniques. And he was actually at the time working on a rig that had just blown out off the coast of India. But when I went into Kuwait and was being driven around the southern oil fields by appointed U.S. military driver, as we drove around the fields, it became pretty apparent to me that the physical evidence that I was witnessing somehow did not support the official version of events. And, you know, we knew a little bit about the campaign and the way in which the military had approached the freeing up of Kuwait from the Iraqi forces, because we'd been watching it on CNN and on Star TV, which was the new satellite channel that was broadcasting throughout the Middle East at the time. And we knew that the US forces had effectively worked a pincer movement. They'd come up the eastern seaboard corridor and come in to Kuwait City from the west, thereby effectively cutting off the southern oil fields. So it was difficult to comprehend how the Iraqi troops had actually set the wells alight and somehow managed to sort of get through this pincer movement. But coupled with that was the absolute physical evidence that I saw in the southern oil fields, which was basically the young Iraqi conscripts lying in their foxholes in defensive positions around the wells with bullet holes in the backs of their necks. So, you know, it pretty much looked as though they'd been assassinated by special forces. Well, I happened to make this observation to the driver, who didn't say very much, but he did look a bit embarrassed. But a couple of days later, I was sitting in the mess of the Kuwaiti oil company having dinner, and this guy in American battle fatigues made a beeline for me. He clearly knew who I was. And basically, he walked over to me, and I mean, I can still remember very clearly what happened there. He walked over, he said, "You're Ian Crane?" And I didn't even get a chance to respond. He just said, "I've been hearing you've been casting some aspersion about who set them wells alight." And then he looked at me, stared at me, opened his eyes real wide. He said, "Boy," he said, "that's the kind of thinking that can get you into a whole lot of trouble, and you best be keeping your mouth shut." And then as he walked away, he turned and looked over his shoulder, and he said, "What's the matter, Ian? Aren't we paying you enough?" And, I mean, although I'm telling the story very glibly 20-plus years after the event, let me tell you, at the time, I was absolutely crapping myself. And I don't think I slept very well for the next couple of days. And it wasn't probably until I got back to Dubai that, maybe I began to sort of feel a little bit of relief. Well, of course, I was being paid very well for what I was doing. And I got on with the job and, I guess, to some extent, put it out of my mind initially. But nonetheless, you know, it didn't rest easy with me. We all knew that April Glaspie and Donald Rumsfeld had effectively baited Saddam into attacking Kuwait, and then, of course, effectively reneged on their agreement that, or on their observation that they weren't going to get involved, and of course kicked him out. So we knew he'd been baited, and now we're looking at a situation where the fires had, in my opinion, been started deliberately. And, you know, Max, it took me 12 years to get corroborative evidence to support my first-hand experience. And that was when I'd shared this story with a colleague, and he had eventually come into contact with somebody who actually acknowledged that he was a member of the special forces who participated in setting the wells alight.
Yeah, well, that would have been a huge wake-up moment for you. I mean, and when you couple that with the baby in the incubator story, I mean, it becomes so apparent that the whole thing was staged. You know, the whole thing was a setup. It was all done simply to go in there and do what they did to Iraq.
Absolutely. And of course, I mean, they didn't manage to complete the job because they realized, George Bush Sr. realized that, he had not got the support of the Arab nations to go all the way to Baghdad. So, of course, they used this demonization of Saddam to effectively put the sanctions in place, which, of course, were in place right up until the events of 2003 when they did invade Iraq. But, you know, Max, people say, you know, why on earth would the Americans do that? Well, there's two reasons. I mean, primarily, of course, it was to demonize Saddam and create the path for the next stage of events, which they hoped, of course, was going to be the invasion, but ended up being sanctions. But the other factor is, of course, that the Emir of Kuwait actually paid the U.S. oil industry $7 billion to put the fires out.
Yeah, yeah, well, that as well. I mean, it's all the strategic placement. I mean, really all people have to do is go and look at the PNAC site, don't they? Go and look at rebuilding America's defenses. It's all in there.
Absolutely.
The whole script was written there. And I know you've done a lot of work on talking about Brzezinski and stuff as well. And if people really ever want to get angry, I think all they really have to do is go and read a book by Zbigniew Brzezinski. And you begin to see just how sociopathic and how methodical these people are.
Well, and of course, the PNAC document was, to all intents and purposes, actually based on Brzezinski's 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard.
Yeah, yeah, I've got that sitting here on my shelf, actually, The Grand Chessboard. That's what I was saying. If you really want to get angry, folks, just go and read The Grand Chessboard. It's all in there, really, isn't it?
Through the course of this discussion, Max, I'm sure we're going to reference Brzezinski, you know, once or twice, because there's absolutely no doubt. And people are very familiar with Kissinger's part in all of this, but you know, they're not so much familiar with Brzezinski. And I think later on we'll talk about Brzezinski and, you know, his part in bringing the technocratic control grid into being.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. He's always said that the future will be dominated by, or the technocratic future will be dominated by an elite that are basically above the law. He's made many statements like that. Now, something else you've done a lot of research into and you've been very outspoken about is things like Codex Alimentarius and the depopulation plan that's obviously going on right under everybody's noses. A lot of people have been saying, well, look, Codex, they didn't bring it in. It didn't get to come in time. But they don't realize that they just bring all these things in gradually under the carpet, don't they? And it's still very much in swing, isn't it?
Oh, not only is it in swing, it's full steam ahead. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Max. I mean, these guys have mastered the art of gradualism. And what they do is they just keep pushing the envelope. They push the envelope. And when there's a reaction, they go, oh, just take a pace back, hold off for a little while, and then they'll start pushing again. And the Codex Agenda was initiated back in 1961, although we can actually trace the philosophy of Codex, which, of course, Codex Alimentarius actually simply means food control.
There was actually the original draft of it, I believe, was way back in World War One, but it was sort of modified. I think it was Fritz de Meer who was in control of a lot of stuff with the Nazis were doing in World War Two. He ended up in jail. I think he developed Codex while he was in jail, didn't he? And presented it to the United Nations, and they loved the idea.
And of course, I mean, you know, the whole of the concept of the European Union comes from the Nazis too. I mean, you know, what we're actually seeing is the fact that, you know, the Nazi agenda.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's what Hitler wanted to do, didn't he? He wanted to unify Europe. And we're seeing that very unified at the moment. Yeah. Funny that.
No, I mean, the Fourth Reich didn't just go away. It didn't go away. It just moved.
Yeah. Yeah. I've often said that the Nazis didn't lose the war. Germany did.
That's a great observation. I couldn't have put it better myself. I mean, they simply moved their power base from Germany, effectively, to what became the UN.
Yeah, look, I've often said that Germany was basically a beta test. They kind of ran this test. Okay, here's how you do it. Here's how we propagandize a whole nation. Here's all the mind control drugs. They all work. Okay, no problem. Now Germany can lose the war. We'll smuggle everybody out. And then we're going to tell the world that we need to install all these military bases everywhere to keep you all safe. And you all need all these food additives and you all need fluoride in your water and all the stuff that we tried in the death camps. And it's just, then they put the United Nations in place, which I consider to be an extension of the Third Reich, basically. Just a subtle version. And then they've gone out and they've done to the world what they did to Germany in World War II.
All under the banner of freedom and democracy.
A wonderful thing, isn't it?
Oh, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. But the good news is that more and more people are actually waking up to this now.
Well, they are. They are, absolutely. So how do you see the Codex? How do you see Codex going at the moment?
Well, you know, here we are 50 years on since the establishment of the Codex Alimentarius Commission. And of course, today it operates under the guise of both the World Health and World Trade Organization. And as we both know, the World Trade Organization has nothing to do with trade. It's about monopoly. And the World Health Organization certainly has absolutely nothing to do with health. It's about sickness. Because there's no money in health, but there's a shed load of money in sickness. And so the Codex Alimentarius Commission today has been totally hijacked by Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, and Big Pharma with an F, the biotech industry. And we have different prongs of attack here in different places around the world. You know, back in 1994, there was a phenomenal move to try and outlaw all natural vitamins and supplements and natural health products in the U.S., but it was Whole Food Stores who actually coordinated the campaign to challenge that. And a piece of legislation was introduced in the U.S. in 1994 called the Shea legislation, the Dietary Supplement Health Education Act, which actually ring-fenced it. And so the Codex agenda had been thwarted temporarily in the U.S. regarding natural health products, so they turned their attention to Europe. But they didn't let the U.S. get off scot-free. All they did was focus their attention in the U.S. on destroying natural farming, destroying the family farmer, and effectively establishing factory farming, which is primarily GM-oriented. So the food chain in the U.S. is totally destroyed. I mean, it's nigh on impossible to get organic products in the U.S. today. And this is evidenced by the fact that legislation in the U.S. permits something to be labeled as organic, even if it has 10% contamination, which, of course, is completely ludicrous. But meanwhile, in Europe, they turn their attention to address the abolition of natural health products. And, of course, everyone says, oh, you know, even people listening probably say, oh, yeah, but this is ridiculous. It'll never happen. Well, you know, we tried to make sure it didn't happen, but on May the 1st of this year, a piece of extremely pernicious legislation came onto the EU statute books, which has the wonderful acronym of THUMPD. This is THMPD, and that stands for the Traditional Herbal Medicines Product Directive, which effectively has given all of the EU governments, which of course are just charades anyway, but it's given the EU governments 2 years to bring onto their statute books the banning of all natural medicines and natural health products. And it's all done under the guise of science doesn't support. I mean, here we go again. It's the technotronic control. Science doesn't support and doesn't give us the evidence to confirm that these natural health products work. So you know, these products that have been handed down for probably millennia, this is knowledge and wisdom that's been handed down, you know, can trace back to the sort of indigenous peoples. And yet in the space of barely 60 years, they're abolished. And we're told that, you know, no longer can we take steps to prevent ourselves from becoming sick. We have to get sick and then, of course, buy into the pharmaceutical agenda. And the pharmaceutical industry has a very, very simple business model, and that is that every human life form is a potential revenue stream from the moment of conception to the moment of death, and they're milking it.
Yeah, it's quite insidious what's going on, really, isn't it?
You couldn't make it up. I mean, this is why, you know, so many people deny or want to deny that this is happening, because they can't actually get their heads around the fact that anybody in their right mind could ever support such an agenda. But you know, the only person that's really fighting this right at the sharp end is a guy called Scott Tipps, who's the president of the National Health Federation, which is based in the U.S. But the National Health Federation actually have NGO rights, non-government organization rights, to attend the Codex Alimentarius Commission meeting, which means that they can participate in the discussion but not vote. So at least Scott has the opportunity to interject into the debate. And unfortunately, you know, many of the country representatives sitting on the Codex Alimentarius Commission are effectively bought and paid for by either the pharmaceutical or the biotech industry. And Scott knows that, you know, the best that he can do is slow down this agenda and until such time as the people actually wake up and realize what's going on and effectively arise en masse.
Well, you know, it's such a multi-pronged attack that everybody's under. You know, you've got Codex doing this with the food. You've got the attack on the water with the fracking, all the CSG stuff that's going on at the moment. You've got the chemtrails. It's so multi-pronged that it's really, really difficult for people to get their heads around it. And that's what the biggest...
And on top of that, Max, of course, right now, we've got this pernicious global financial meltdown, which is being manipulated. In fact, I'm here in Australia right now because, I mean, Australia is the only country in the developed world that hasn't had the rug pulled from under its economy just yet. Unfortunately, there are a few people in Australia who are starting to wake up to this fact and realize that, you know, Australia is actually being set up for a massive fall. But in the rest of the world, what it means is that people are focused on literally keeping the roof over their heads and food on their table. So even if they have the interest in pursuing, you know, this kind of information, they don't have the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what the money system's all about, isn't it? It's about keeping people in a state of permanent debt so they're always on the treadmill and they simply don't notice what's going on around them.
Exactly.
I say to people sometimes, look, you're rushing so fast. Where are you going? You know, think about what you're doing in your life. What purpose is it all serving? And it's very, very difficult for them to just stop and see that it's not serving anything. You know, I sort of look around in fascination sometimes and just everybody's running everywhere at 100 miles an hour and they're all going absolutely nowhere and they just don't notice.
But they're a product of a system. I mean, the system has been developed, you know, right from birth. You know, the system is developed to actually get them into this slave mode.
Mm,
so that the only thing they know is chasing the dollar.
Yeah, it's incredibly complex and it's incredibly clever the way it's all been put in place. Like the whole indoctrination system from cradle to grave. It's incredible. I mean, as soon as they can get you out of the hands of your parents and get you into these schools and indoctrinate you. I mean, this is what women's liberation was all about. Get the mothers away from the home, get the children into daycare, and you also get to tax the other half of the population because you've got all the women working now. Brilliant
exactly.
plan. Like, they're so clever and methodical with what they do, and it's they do it over such long periods of time. Like, time is nothing to them. They don't mind planning 50 years ahead or 100 years ahead. And that's something that's very difficult for people to get their heads around.
No, absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely right. These guys work on multi-generational agendas, whereas obviously what they're trying to do with the general public is keep them focused in on the short term. I mean, for most people, you know, they could barely think from paycheck to paycheck, or, you know, the next episode of their favorite soap or the next sport event. I mean, it is incredible how people are locked into, if you like, the bread and circuses. And like you say, it's brilliant. And, you know, we shouldn't certainly take anything away from the fact that these guys are masterful in putting their strategy together. But, you know, like in all sport, you only really improve your own performance when you're playing against teams that are better than you.
Well, they are definitely getting sloppy, but people really do need to wake up to what's going on because it's getting quite serious. And that's why it's good that people such as yourself are out there spreading the message to people. I've been going and doing talks around here myself. Recently, because it just needs to be done.
Well, Max, I mean, you know, listen, no one of us can really make any impact on this on our own. But collectively, you know, we are incredibly powerful. And when I say collectively, I don't mean forming an organization or forming a political party, because they love that kind of approach, because they can infiltrate that in a heartbeat. What scares the crap out of these guys is this loose-knit grouping of people with similar interests. It's what I call, you know, people coming together as a community of interest. But there's no leadership. You know, there's no constitution. It's literally people coming together because they want to address a particular issue. It's extremely difficult for them to infiltrate. It's extremely difficult for them to railroad.
Yeah, you've just got to have an empowered humanity. That's something I've been trying to do very, very much on my shows, is help people understand how powerful they really are, because it's the community that we have. If we can build community within the community that we have by simply connecting with our neighbors and breaking down all the division that we have with each other, which is all based on fear. It's all your fear of the guy next door and your fear of the people up the road and your fear of not having as much stuff as your neighbors and all this sort of stuff. It's absurd. We've got to look through all the haze, just look through it and connect with each other, realize that we're all in this together. And we're facing some serious issues, but they could be healed very, very quickly. We could clear it up in one day if we would all simply connect with each other and stop and turn to face it, really.
No, that's absolutely right. And you know, for those of us, who, of course, who you know, are trying to raise that awareness, it would be wonderful if it happened overnight. But I think we're realists, and we know that, you know, basically this is a long game. And we know that the awareness of what's going on is increasing on a logarithmic scale. Now, I don't know at which point we reach that proverbial 100th monkey, or, you know, that critical mass. But we just got to keep going until we do. But as, you know, I think we all acknowledge, once people actually see through this, and, you know, different people have different points at which they see through it. You know, for some, you know, it might be 9/11 or the Bali bombings, or, you know, it might be what's going on with Codex, or it might be what's going on with the financial meltdown. But once people see the first domino fall, then it doesn't take much for them to actually see that all the other pieces of the jigsaw actually do connect. And there's no going back. Well, in fact, I think, Max, you've interviewed the only person that I've ever come across who's actually done a 180, having...
Yeah, well, I don't know what to make of that one. I mean, I like you say, once you're awake, you can't go back to sleep.
You can't go back. It's not possible. Exactly.
It's absolutely impossible. So I don't know what to make of that one. Charlie Veach, of course, you're talking about, aren't you?
Oh, like, good guess.
Yeah, but like you say, once you wake up, you can't go back to sleep, because it's absolutely paradigm changing. And a lot of people, when it first hits them, they go into a meltdown, because they find that everything they thought was real about reality is actually completely false. And it's like waking up from the Matrix. It really is.
No, it absolutely really is. And I completely understand, you know, when people do go through the fear and the anger. And these are actually important stages. I mean, it's important to go through the fear. Well, I certainly did back in, you know, the early 90s. It's important to go through that, go through the anger, you know, that we've been manipulated. And of course we get angry that we've been manipulated and treated as idiots and imbeciles. But once you get through that, then you're actually in the right frame of mind to decide, you know, where it is that you want to put your energies and where you want to focus, because no one of us can focus on every issue. You know, we need people to focus on specific issues, and then we need people, you know, to sort of bring it all together and look at the sort of global aspect of this. But Max, you know, the critical factor for me, and this is what I really say to people when they ask, you know, why it is that I've effectively devoted my time and energy, you know, to this. And I say, look, it's not about the now so much, but it's about the legacy that we're leaving future generations. I mean, absolutely appalls me to think that our children and our grandchildren are going to inherit a world that we have participated, albeit unwittingly. But now we know, we got no excuse, but we have participated in effectively turning this, or starting the process of turning this into an uninhabitable rock.
Yeah, look, very much, very much. And we've participated by our non-participation. That's the problem. And I say to people, look, you know, unfortunately, either you're part of the solution or you're part of the problem. Because, you know, we do face a very, very real problem. We're not being good custodians of our planet and the legacy that we're leaving behind for our children. I mean, we're creating a world that will be uninhabitable by our inaction. And we've got to just stop focusing on all this rubbish, this acquisition of rubbish and this acquisition of social status or peer status or all this stuff that we get taught is real. And to just look at what's going on around us and see, you know, the tragic state of humanity and the tragic state of life on this planet due to our non-participation in our own lives, essentially. Well, because we're taught to have this life that the television tells us we should have, and that's really not what it's about at all.
No, absolutely. And in fact, I think it was George Carlin who said, those who don't watch TV and those who don't read newspapers know a damn sight more than those who do.
Yeah, absolutely. They say if you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read the newspaper, you're misinformed.
That is so true. I mean, I haven't watched television in probably 7 years. You know, I refuse to have one connected in the house. And I must confess that, you know, I do read the newspapers, but I read the newspapers because, you know, I want to know what BS it is that's being fed to the masses.
Well, basically, yeah, that's the only reason I read the papers as well. I've actually never owned a television. When I was married, my wife brought one into the house, but I haven't had one in my house for probably 15 years. I don't have a mobile phone either or any credit cards. So I've never really participated in the system that way. But look, I think it's break time here, so we better go and have a break now. We're here talking with Ian Crane, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Thank you for listening. Welcome back, folks. We're here talking with Ian R. Crane. We've been talking all things New World Order, all things about the future. We've been discussing what's going on with Codex Alimentarius and how Ian got into this knowledge that he has at the moment. And as I said, he's quite unique in this because he was an oil company executive and he's kind of woken up to things and now he's out going around the world speaking out about what's going on. Now, something that's going on in this country, Ian, very, very much at the moment, and is going on all around the world, is fracking, coal seam gas mining. Now, this is absolutely insidious, and what's being done in this country is, I mean, I've just actually flown over the country. I've just come back from Broome. I've flown up over the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, which looks like the moon at the moment. It looks like a lunar crater. And this coal seam gas, this fracking, is going on all across the country, and it's salinating the soil. It's absolutely destroying people's lives. It's bringing all sorts of toxins up from below the ground, and it's also destroying the water table. And I absolutely believe that one of the main purposes of coal seam gas mining is to destroy the water table. I mean, let's face it, we don't need coal seam gas anyway. But this all ties in, when you think about the destruction of the water table, this, I suggest, all ties in with what we were talking about before with Codex Alimentarius and Agenda 21, driving people into the cities, concentrating and controlling humanity. What's your take on all of this?
I think you pretty much nailed it there, Max. I mean, the fracking agenda is, again, extremely pernicious. And in fact, I first started to try and raise people's awareness about this a number of years ago, but I was clearly using the wrong terminology because I was using my oil field terminology. So I was talking about, you know, the dangers of reservoir stimulation, and of course, you know, unfortunately, people didn't realize, you know, what I was talking about or didn't appreciate the severity of it. And I got a handed really to Josh Fox, because it's Josh Fox and the release of his absolutely superb documentary Gasland that has, no pun intended, but sort of, if you like, ignited the debate on this. And it's a very, very timely, you know, because the whole fracking agenda, I first came across the fracking process, you know, 20 odd years ago. And at the time I was asking the questions. I was saying, you know, well, what is in this chemical cocktail that we're pumping into the reservoirs under extremely high pressure? You know, what kind of control do we have as to where these chemicals are migrating to? And of course, I was simply fobbed off and told, look, Ian, don't worry about it. You know, our guys in the R&D teams, they've looked at all this, and it's absolutely safe. It's not an issue. And by the way, you know, we're making shed loads of money from doing this operation. So, you know, don't go challenging it. And, you know, to be honest, I basically said, shrugged my shoulders and got on with it at the time. But then when I was in the U.S., I was working in the U.S. between 1995 and 1998. And I did start to really get concerned as I was touring around the U.S. and visiting our various locations, because, you know, the prevalence of the fracking operation in all of the oil field locations around the U.S. was incredible. And there's so many people in the U.S. in particular who are reliant on underground aquifers for their water supply. And, you know, I thought, well, hang on a second, what happens when this stuff migrates into the water supply? And back in the 1990s, there really wasn't too much evidence of an issue. Well, if there was, it was being suppressed. But of course, here we are 25 years or so into the fracking agenda in the U.S. I mean, there had been some nominal fracking before that, but it tended to be done with water. It tended to be done purely with water being pumped under pressure. It was really around about the late 80s or so, that the toxic cocktails of chemicals started to be used to accelerate the fracking process. And of course, the purpose of fracking is to open up the geology, to create channels for the hydrocarbons to accelerate the speed to which they reach the bottom of the well and then can be brought to the surface. And by opening these seams, with these cocktails, of course, you know, there is no control. You can't actually say, actually, you know what, we're just going to limit this to opening the scene to X meters or whatever. You have no control over it at all. It just goes wherever it is. The geology allows it to go. And, of course, what's happened is now there's phenomenal evidence of contaminated water courses, the aquifers, because in many cases, of course, it was the water that was actually keeping the gas in the seams and preventing it from rising to the surface. So, you know, either the water is being removed, or with the pressure, the channels have been opened so that the stuff just flows freely into the water supply. And as Josh Fox's film shows so eloquently, there's many, many people throughout the US now, and this is what's going to happen in Australia and elsewhere, many people can literally set light to their tap.
Yeah, it's outrageous, isn't it?
Well, I mean, setting light to it might seem like a bit of a party trick, but of course, you know, when people are drinking this, it means they're ingesting it. And of course, there's many, many cases of you know, people's health deteriorating. They're not realizing that it's linked to the fact that they're drinking contaminated tap water. And now, as there has been an increased awareness of the link between the fracking process and the contamination of water supplies, the fracking companies and the oil companies are literally shipping bottled water to these people in the working the farmlands around the coal gas and the shale rock areas where they're fracking on a literally almost on a monthly basis sometimes.
Yeah, it's absolutely shocking. And look, a lot of people have been saying, look, when you look at Agenda 21, you look at the maps, and they've got the concentrated areas of population, and people say, well, I won't move. I've got my guns. I'm here. I'm staying, you know. And there's people going out and setting up their little alternate societies and their kind of new age hippie places, and they're saying, oh, we'll be here. We'll be self-sustainable, and we won't participate in the system. All of these people, I mean, they're not dealing with the aspect of what are you going to do when the water's polluted? What are you going to do when the air's full of chemtrails and there's all the aluminiums in the soil and your food isn't going to grow unless you buy GM Monsanto food? What are you going to do? And aren't these people, by going and creating these alternate societies and going and setting themselves up as being this big fortress in the country, they're really just helping the agenda, aren't they? Because they're not uniting with the people around them to address this problem. They're just hiding away and hoping to be picked off last, essentially.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it's extremely selfish. And you just reminded me of Dr. John Coleman in his book Committee of 300, which he wrote in the early 80s and published in 86. In that book, he makes the observation that the New Age movement was a construct. I mean, it may have started organically, but then once those who manipulate the global agenda realize the opportunity here of pumping acid into the burgeoning hippie community and encouraging them to pursue a path of spiritual narcissism, it effectively took them out the game.
Well, it does. And then while that's been happening, all of these people have also been brought into this technotronic way of living as well. Everybody's got a laptop, everyone's got their digital phones and all this sort of stuff. So, and they're talking about microchips. There's even people in Japan and in other countries that have chips because it's easier to go through the checkout at the supermarket. It's easy to scan yourself into work and all this sort of stuff. So we seem to be heading towards this very machine-like society, don't we? Along with this whole, you know, I'll be spiritual, plus I'll be almost like the Borg. I mean, this is sort of where it seemed to be attempting to take us.
Yeah, post-humanism. And we can trace this. We can trace this back to the 1930s. I mean, people are obviously very familiar with the works like George Orwell and it was H.G. Wells who wrote The New World Order in the 1940s and Aldous Huxley and his Brave New World. But, you know, we can actually go back to Marion King Hubbard, and a lot of people know the name of Marion King Hubbard because of his link with the peak oil construct, another political construct. And it shouldn't surprise people to learn that, you know, Marion King Hubbard was a member of the Club of Rome. And by the way, he didn't like people calling him Marion, so he had people call him King. So no ego there then, eh? And anyway, he was the author or co-author of a document that I think it was published in 1934 called Technocracy, Inc. And basically what he was doing was laying the foundations for everything that we see pretty much in place today of this control grid and a world ruled by technocrats. And this theme was further developed. I mean, Buckminster Fuller got in on the act. Zbigniew Brzezinski, when he wrote Between Two Ages, the Technotronic Era, which he wrote in 69, published in 1970, it's developing that theme even further. And now, of course, what we've got is the Genie Project, which is the global electricity network. And groups, Max, I have to say, I am very, very concerned about the way in which groups like the Zeitgeist Movement are corralling the 20s and 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds who believe that, you know, the way forward is to embrace this technocratic society, this technotronic control grid, and to the exclusion of all else. And as you rightly say, what they're pushing towards is this post-humanism, which absolutely incorporates the chip. In fact, there's a YouTube clip that I saw recently of a post-humanist within academia who's talking about you know, chipping children at birth. And basically, of course, he initially says, well, of course, mothers would have the choice, but why would they not chip their children, you know, when they will be giving their children the opportunity to have a brain capacity that's just far in advance of, you know, the normal human brain. And these guys don't seem to be able to get their heads around the fact that what we're talking about here is effectively turning man into an economic slave.
Well, absolutely, and using every means possible to do it. I mean, people don't understand. I mean, I've spoken so much about it on the show that you're an electromagnetic being. Everything you experience is electrical. And when you get locked into these electrical type societies, and what you're saying as well with this grid they're putting down, this electrical grid, the Genie program with all the smart meters, all these sorts of things which will read how many times you open your fridge and will read the electrical signals of your body as well.
Yep.
And you see what's going on here, and you can see how this is all being put into place, and it's quite shocking, and people are being led down the garden path. And what people don't realize is that this extra intelligence they are offering people seems so attractive because they've locked people off from everything that they're actually capable of themselves by locking them into one side of their brain and basically shutting their DNA down, shutting their pineal gland down, filling them full of fluoride. And it's like, you're a lot more likely to buy my Honda if I come and steal your Ferrari first. You know what I mean?
Exactly, exactly. I mean, it is mindscaping and manipulation. And I can imagine someone stumbling across this discussion, and they're just going to go, my God, these guys, you know, what is up with these guys? You know, are these guys delusional? But, of course, the reality is that we have simply read the scripts. I mean, we can literally point people to the scripts, to the right-wing think tanks, to the books written by the likes of Brzezinski, to the Earth Conference, the Rio Conference of 1992, which, of course, was the brainchild of Maurice Strong. And that's where we get Agenda 21 from. So, you know, we've read the scripts. We know where it is they're heading. We know why it is that they're so desperate to keep people removed from these scripts. They certainly believe that they have to put this information out there. They certainly believe they have to make it available. And what we've done is access that. But well, they work on the basis that the vast majority of people will not look at it, and thereby not look at it, by not looking at it, sorry, their apathy or their willful ignorance actually gives them the power to pursue their agenda.
Well, absolutely, and they always put it right out there in plain view, and that's the thing, you can find all of this information. They tell you about it, what they're going to do years in advance, like with the Iron Mountain Report, which came out in the 60s, and there's your whole global warming agenda, there's your whole climate change agenda outlined in that book, saying, listen, this would be a great thing to do, this is the global crisis we could create. And they just put it out there for you. And the Georgia Guidestones, here we go. We want to reduce the population by about, you know, 90%.
Yep.
And we'll just put it up there and we'll just put it up there and tell you all about it and see if anybody complains. So they do this all the time and they're very, very blasé about it.
But then every now and again, Max, something occurs which thwarts them or forces them to rethink their strategy. And that's one of the reasons that Australia and New Zealand are on point now with regards the carbon tax, which of course is the precursor to carbon trading. Because up until a couple of years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, these guys were on a roll, and they thought that they were literally a matter of weeks away from being able to lay the foundations of global governance at the Copenhagen meeting, which was December 2009.
Hmm.
And in fact, I recorded a presentation called The Green Agenda and Population Reduction in middle November of 2009. I made the observation, I said, you know, unless something truly amazing and remarkable happens within the next few weeks, by the end of this year, we are going to have the basic framework in place for global governance and a new global currency, i.e. carbon trading. Well, little did I know that a few days after I recorded that presentation, the ClimateGate emails were going to be released.
Hmm.
And of course, this was seminal. This was a seminal moment, because nobody could have anticipated this event. But it didn't take too long. It didn't even take much more than a cursory study of the ClimateGate emails to realize that the whole thing was a political construct.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it was, and like we say, it was just, the whole Iron Mountain report and everything. So look, we're almost out of time. What's a quick rundown on 2012? What's your take on 2012, Ian?
Look, 2012, I mean, I put together a presentation that was released as a DVD about 5 years ago now called Hidden Agenda 2012. And it's still available. And the reason it's still available is because everything I discussed in that presentation is coming to pass. And I'm still absolutely convinced that these guys are going to stage an event, the London Olympics. In fact, I've become even more specific. I think it's going to be the closing ceremony at the London Olympics. It's going to be August the 12th. And they're going to stage something that is so audacious that they're going to use this as the opportunity to accelerate their agenda towards global governance. And it's also my belief that these guys are running scared. And the reason they're running scared is because within the inner sanctum, and the inner sanctum is those that John Coleman used to refer to as the Olympians, because of some of their knowledge and insight into some of the ancient texts, they are also very concerned that they may actually be about to be taken off the planet. And I know this sounds incredible, but, I mean, it's all laid out. And, in fact, in the Book of Enoch, you know, it actually references the year of mystery. And some of these guys believe that the year of mystery, the year that they are removed and all their descendants are removed from the planet, may be 2012. Now, just take a look at what's going on. Consider the possibility that they're taking a stance of, you know what, if we can't have this rock, neither can you. Which is why what we're seeing now is this horrendous agenda to effectively destroy the ecology of the planet. You know, whether it's the depleted uranium that's being dropped, you know, right across the globe, particularly in the Middle East, now in Libya. You know, whether it's the fracking, the poisoning of the water supply through fracking, the purposeful addition of fluoride to shut down, as you say, our ability to connect with the secretions of the pineal gland, the poisoning of our food chain by the introduction of GM foods. I mean, look at what's going on here. Look at the evidence of what's occurring here. So I think that we're in for one hell of a ride over the next 18 months. But you know what, Max? Deep in my heart, I know we're going to come through. I know we're going to win. We've got a hell of a battle on our hands. We're up against a formidable opponent. But as humanity really starts to wake up to what's going on here, I believe that collectively we can come through this.
Yeah, it's all about opportunity, really, isn't it? It's all a really, really wonderful opportunity for human consciousness to come into itself. Well, I think we're about out of time.
Okay.
But it's been a pleasure having you on the show. You're speaking all around Australia at the moment in Melbourne, Sydney, Gold Coast and Brisbane, I believe. You'll be speaking in Melbourne tonight. So anybody out there who's listening to the show tonight, go and check out Ian Crane in Melbourne. Whereabouts is the gig in Melbourne, Ian?
In Melbourne, it's at the convention centre. I believe it's locally known as the Shed.
The Shed in Melbourne tonight, folks. So if you're in Melbourne listening to this show, please go and check out Ian Crane tonight. It'll be well worth the talk, and I'll look forward to speaking to you soon. And I'll come up and see you on the Gold Coast on Sunday.
Yep, it's at the Gold Coast Arts Centre in Blundell Road, Surfers Paradise, on Sunday, kicking off at 10:30 in the morning.
Okay, what's the one after that?
The one after that is in Brisbane. And I would encourage people to go to the website, although be very careful when you're putting the website domain name in there, because the website for the event is The Hidden Agenda 2012. Please don't forget the 2012, because if you just put in The Hidden Agenda, you're going to arrive at a very, very different website.
Okay, not a problem. Been a pleasure having you on the show, Ian.
Thanks, Max. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care, my friend.
And that was Ian R. Crane, ladies and gentlemen, a most informed individual. And don't forget, if you are in Australia, he is speaking in Melbourne tonight at The Shed. That is Saturday the 5th of November. He's speaking at the Gold Coast on Sunday the 6th of November, in Brisbane on Wednesday the 9th of November, and then he's continuing on to New Zealand, where he'll be speaking in Auckland on Friday the 11th, Wellington on Saturday the 12th, and Dunedin on Sunday the 13th, after which he'll be back in the UK. And I was especially pleased to hear Ian's solutions to the problems that we face, which is very much what I've been telling you on this show for such a long time. Well, we are pretty well out of time here now, folks. Thank you very much for the literally thousands of birthday messages I received on my birthday last week. Please don't send me any more. My mailbox has been overflowing quite nicely, and I do thank you very much for that. But as I said, please no more. Thank you for the support that you've shown me and that you continue to show me. Thank you for continuing to visit thecrowhouse.com. There's a lot of new links that have been put on there this week. So don't forget to visit the website and check those out. There are also a few new interviews that have been posted up there, and there will be some more posted up there within the next few days. But I will have to leave it here now, folks. We are completely out of time. It has been a pleasure speaking to you again today. And I'll look forward to speaking to you again next week. Please take care until then. In La Cache.